This is Gabfest Radio, a weekly program about politics and culture from Slate and WNYC. On this week's Political Gabfest, are we a step closer to a compromise in the government shutdown and debt ceiling crises? Also, Justice Scalia gives an extraordinary interview to New York Magazine. I'm David Plotz.
And I'm Stephen Metcalf. On this week's Culture Gabfest, Masters of Sex, does Showtime's new series about early sex research educate, titillate, or irritate? Then, Coolness in 2013. We'll discuss what defines the know-it-when-you-see-it state of hipness these days.
We have to go, we have to go, go, go! Explorer's been hit!
What do I do?
And then Alfonso Cuarón's new film is Gravity. Critics are calling the space drama out of this world. Will it win us over, too? We'll start with the Political Gabfest right after the news.
I'm gonna make it, all right?
I can't breathe!
Hello and welcome to Gabfest Radio from Slate and WNYC. I'm David Plotz in Washington. Are the president and Republicans inching towards a compromise that would lift the debt ceiling in exchange for negotiations over entitlement and tax reform? Then, in an interview, Justice Scalia reveals that he believes in the devil, listens to conservative talk radio, and doesn't like women cursing. Are you surprised by that? Joining me in Washington is Slate's chief political correspondent, John Dickerson. Hello, John.
Hello, David.
And from New Haven, Slate senior editor Emily Bazelon. Hi, Emily.
Hey, David.
As we tape on Thursday afternoon, the continents in the debt ceiling standoff are shifting. The tectonic plates are moving. They are moving, actually seem to be moving rapidly. With the October 17th debt ceiling deadline, I put deadline in quotes in case some of our Republican listeners who are not sure it is a deadline want to cast doubt on that, which we'll discuss. With that deadline looming, there are about six or seven major themes emerging. I want to quickly mention them, and then John will explain every single one of them.
Six or seven? That's way too many for me to hold in my head.
All right. I'm going to be really quick. One, A. I wrote them as A, B, C, D, E, F. So A.
Do you normally do that?
Sometimes I do one. Sometimes I do A.
You are a man who contains multitudes. Continue.
A. Oy. Business groups traditionally allied with Republicans are angry at the Republicans about the shutdown continuing. They want the shutdown, the debt ceiling fight over. B, poll numbers are atrocious for the GOP. They're not so great for the Democrats or President Obama either, but the Republicans are really, really seeing a cratering in their poll numbers. Approval ratings are at all-time lows, according to one poll released this week. C, there's a set of Republicans, mostly conservatives of the Tea Party ilk, who are expressing doubt that a debt ceiling breach would actually be disastrous. Some are saying we have until November 1st when there's a whole set of payments that come due. Others are saying we can have a lot longer if we just prioritize payments. We'll just cut back a lot on government services. Others are saying, yeah, it'll be bad, but you know what? Obamacare is even worse, so we have to be careful about that. D, let's go to movement. President Obama gave a press conference this week where he hinted he would be open to a short-term deal and then would negotiate during that deal. The Dickerson scenario laid out.
He was explicit. He didn't hint.
Laid out during that deal. He was explicit. That's right. E, Paul Ryan, influential House Republican, the House Budget Committee chair and a godhead among many Republicans, had an op-ed on Wednesday where he did not mention Obamacare as something that to come out of this resolution, but he proposed kind of shifting the showdown to a discussion over entitlements and tax reform. So F, perhaps most importantly, on Thursday, House Republicans unveiled a proposal for a short 6-week debt ceiling lift, not a government shutdown lift, giving time to negotiate with the president. Phew, that is a lot of stuff going on. John, what really matters here?
Well, I was writing by number and not letter, but the final thing is on Thursday, the Senate jumped in, Senate Republicans jumped in with a measure for continuing the funding of the government. So just on David's last point, the House was preparing and had kind of coalesced, House Republicans had coalesced around a deal to have a clean debt limit increase of 6 weeks, after which negotiations could start with the White House about debt, spending, and growth and taxes. But the shutdown would continue. The Senate said, no, we're going to end the shutdown and put this kind of a deal together, which—
Wait, Senate Republicans or Senate Democrats?
Senate Republicans, uh-huh. Led by Susan Collins of Maine, which is throwing a cat among the pigeons on the House side, because a lot of the conservatives in the House have this theory, which I think is a little wobbly. I think it's a lot wobbly, which is, okay, let the debt limit be raised because that we don't want to mess with a default or prioritization or whatever you want to call it. But we'll keep the Obamacare fight going on the shutdown government funding front because we think we're winning that.
So, Emily, doesn't this proposal to sort of have a short-term debt ceiling lift, doesn't this just extend the hostage-taking?
That's my fear. And also that it won't really reassure the markets. We'll just have a longer period of less dramatic market shakiness that will allow the crazy denialists to continue to fiddle their way to inglory. And that we'll have to doesn't everyone want to be finished with this? I just can't understand how people can have a tolerance for continuing this totally insane way of governing the country.
The deal here is not to do anything grand. It's basically to take the gun from the side of your head. I mean, there's
But if the gun is only gone for 6 weeks, what's the difference?
Well, the difference is you don't have a hole in your head. You know, I'm not saying this is the greatest thing in the world, but it's the nuclear clock gets set back, you know, 5 minutes. The shape of a deal between both sides has always been there. It's just a
right.
question of, you know, so at least they get sort of back to that. It's incredibly frustrating. It might not yield anything, but it's better than a collapse. And on the denialist part, I think it's basically true that there would not be a default on the 17th of October, which actually now the Treasury has admitted. But that's kind of a semantic game, which is that once
right.
you get to the 17th and you have to play this game of prioritization,
right.
listeners are probably too young to remember the Lucy in I Love Lucy when she works at the candy factory and the conveyor belt moves faster than she can operate. That's essentially what you would get into.
It almost feels to me, I'm sure I'm wrong about this, that this is all an incredibly canny, the whole thing has been this incredibly canny Republican setup to reach this point where there's President Obama is going to be forced to do a major entitlement reform deal that includes no tax increases. I suspect he'll end up having to sign something. I don't think he can go into negotiations and say, I'm negotiating with you, I'm negotiating with you, I'm negotiating with you. Republicans appear to be offering something which he has offered in the past, and then he says, I won't do any of these deals.
Well, he's been able to maintain that position for a pretty long time, so.
It's kind of different when you come out of a hostage-taking situation. You're like, okay, now we're all equal. We all really want to do something. And Republicans are like, here are 10 things we want to do.
Yeah, but he can shift he'll do, because look, Republicans are not incredibly popular right now. And after this Obamacare cul-de-sac, they're really not popular. I mean, the president changes the terms of debate all the time. So he'll just say, well, I offered to be a good faith negotiator and you came with these crazy ideas. And so they're crazy and I'm not going to go for them.
Well, we'll have exactly the same showdown.
We have an impasse, you know, and we will still be stuck with the impasse. The solution to the nuclear moment doesn't change any of the underlying junk we've been dealing with for the last 5 years.
Can I ask a question, though, about a systematic question, maybe, if that's the right way to characterize it? I've been thinking that, you know, President Obama has not been shy about increasing executive power in many ways. And yet he's really, really loath to raise the debt ceiling on his own. I've been thinking, you know, what if he just says, presidents have the power to do this, and from now on, I'm going to do it, and other presidents can do it too. And we just take raising the debt ceiling off the table as something that Congress gets to hold you hostage over. Wouldn't we be better off?
How can he do that?
Because there's a plausible constitutional argument. He can invite them to impeach him.
We talked about this.
I know we talked about it. I just wonder, okay, forget the legal questions of whether he could do it. Just go with me for a moment. There's a plausible argument. Wouldn't we be better off with a system in which this president can single-handedly raise the debt ceiling?
So the objection to this is not legal, nor is it political. The objection is that it doesn't do anything to calm the markets, that if the president does this and it gets into the courts, that's a realm of massive uncertainty, and the fate of bondholders, the value of those bonds they hold, is going to be adjudicated in the court system. This is the White House argument.
But I just don't buy this at all for 1 second, because I think if Obama said clearly, I have the power to do this, the courts would stay out of it in the ways that they tend to do. And why are you all smirking?
I'm not smirking. I'm exchanging. Mike Wuolo is telling me to wrap up, and I'm like, this is interesting.
Oh.
So I was giving him the finger, and he was then giving me gestures back. Because you were saying interesting
stuff. I just
don't.
The whole it's going to be tied up in the courts forever and the president doesn't really have the power to calm the markets. I think if he asserted it, he would have a pretty good shot at calming the markets. And I really think we would be better off with this particular usurpation of executive power.
He cannot actually usurp that power unless there's a state of emergency, because the debt limit.
Arguably.
The debt limit. No.
Right, but they're saying you can't bank on arguably.
I get that. But he could have played his whole hand on this differently. He could have said, go ahead, don't raise the debt ceiling. And then done it himself. Like, he could have been saying all along, I have the power to do this.
I bet you're right, Emily, that we get there. But I don't think I don't think this president is going to do it. I bet the next time there's a Republican president with the Republican majorities in the House and Senate, this will happen. But I don't think it's going to happen.
Kind of infuriating.
So,
okay,
so hold on. But imagine this. The president says, you know, okay, let's say I was to do this and the market tanks 500 points. If that's the way he views the world and that's the way they say they view the world, then what's the explanation to him? Of why he's not on the hook for having tanked
the market. I just don't think that is plausible for 1 second that the market would tank 500 points. I don't think people – do you think the market is like, oh, I'm not sure that's – no, the market would be like, thank you, Mr. President. What a relief. Goodbye. Everyone would go home and cheer. No one wants to think about this anymore.
This is based on Emily's years as a trader. The market went up 200 points today on the back basis of some totally stupid phony baloney.
But you're just swallowing the White House Kool-Aid. I just don't think there is – this is a
no, no, I'm not swallowing it.
There is no answer.
But no, I'm not swallowing it. I'm giving you the White House position, which you then have to change their mind. You can't change their mind by just saying you're wrong. You have to then offer an alternate – and the alternative you're offering is a market behavior that guys – like Jack Lew don't believe or say they don't believe is going to happen. So you have to come up with some better argument, don't you, to like convince them?
I feel like I've gone on too long about this. The other night we were talking about the legal argument for this. It's a plausible constitutional argument. They could just offer it and see how the markets responded to the idea of it. And of course you're not going to know how the markets are really going to respond until you try it. He could raise the debt ceiling right now. He could go and say, I raised the debt ceiling. This is over, and see what happens.
Coming up, Supreme Court Justice Scalia gives a fascinating interview to a reporter. You're listening to GabFest Radio from Slate and WNYC. This is GabFest Radio. I'm David Plotz, along with Emily Bazelon and John Dickerson, and this is the political GabFest portion of the show. Let's move on to our next topic. Jennifer Senior interviewed Justice Antonin Scalia for New York Magazine this week, and the justice did not disappoint. He revealed his news-consuming habits, the Wall Street Journal, Washington Times for newspapers, conservative talk radio for radio, very little television, seemingly. His religious principles. He would like a more evangelical Catholic church. He doesn't really want the church to change its teachings on homosexuality. He doesn't like women who curse. He doesn't like anyone who curses, really. He insists he doesn't hate gays. He believes the devil is real. And he very effectively scoffed at his interviewer, Jen Senior, when she expressed skepticism about his belief that the devil is real. So, Emily, what did we learn about Scalia from this, both as a person and as a jurist? Did we find anything surprising or new? I, for one, was not surprised to learn that he doesn't like women cursing. He doesn't. His views on homosexuality haven't changed. He listens to conservative talk radio and reads the Washington Times. Those are not things that were surprising to me.
Good point. I was interested that he no longer considers himself a faint-hearted originalist, that if he had a do-over, he would say that flogging may be really stupid, but it's perfectly constitutional. I would like to know how he's now going to justify things like Brown versus Board, the desegregation decision, which in other contexts he has linked to being a faint-hearted originalist, but maybe now he thinks the 14th Amendment gets you there. And I was also really interested that he is so pessimistic about the future. There was a moment where he talked about how he doesn't think the world will be a better place for his grandchildren and that he thinks things are going downhill. And I feel like that's key. It helped explain to me why he was so so cheery, or at least unaffected by the idea. He said, you know, I may be an old fogey, maybe all my ideas will be obsolete, but I really don't care. And I suppose if you think that the world is going to hell in a handbasket, then it doesn't matter to you that you could be on the wrong side of history.
Aren't there are two kinds of conservatives? There are the conservatives who believe the world is getting worse and the conservatives who believe the world is getting better.
And yeah,
this is
a
very traditional kind of conservative. I mean, it is that you know, we're born in sin. Everything is headed towards despair and squalor and sorrow. And it's not sort of pie-in-the-sky, libertarian-esque optimism. It's very much like man is brutal and sinful and has terrible base urges, and we do cruel things to each other, and it's all going to get worse.
Right. I wonder why then it means that you have to only read the words of the Constitution in the way that they were defined in 1789. Like, how does that get you there?
Well, if you believe that everything since 1789 has gotten worse, why apply the bad thinking of today?
I guess so, but if you're real Hobbesian, wouldn't you think things were bad then too? I mean, why do you have your faith in that? I don't know.
It's a good point. So, Emily, I want to ask you a question, which is what struck me in this interview was the number of times that he disagreed with his own thinking in the past. So you mentioned one of the things he repudiated his definition of being a faint-hearted originalist. And then he talked about the flaws in the Constitution and that he would one of the things he would change is the amendment provision. And he says
make
that was not originally a flaw.
Presumably.
Yeah, he said that was not originally a flaw, but the country has changed so much. So here in his own thinking, he admits a change in his own thinking as he's experienced life. And then also he wants the Constitution to change because in its original design, it didn't fit with the way the country
changed.
Well,
but that's not him saying his views have changed on it. He's just saying that the—
No, he's saying his own views on being a faint-hearted originalist.
No, that has. But
right.
on the amendment provision, that's not something where he says that my views have changed.
But his point
is— onto something,
yeah.
Right?
Thank you. Go
it's
ahead,
It's a different
Emily,
kind of living Constitution.
Right. You
change it by amending it.
Right. And also, it seems to me that you are either a textualist and an originalist, and that's it. But you can't then say, but the one part I would change because the country has changed is this part. Because isn't that justification for all the other things that people want to change in interpreting the Constitution is that the country has changed and therefore the interpretation of the letter of the Constitution has to go along with it. So he's talking about a physical change. That's fine. But it seems to me that once you – I mean, I'm sure I'm out of my depth here, but it seems to me you either have to be all in or not.
But
I think
him.
He would make an important methodological distinction. He would say that as a judge, he doesn't have a power to reinterpret the amendment about amending in a different way.
Right.
But that if we, the people, get it together to amend that amendment,
yes.
He would applaud us.
I guess that's – right. That's exactly right. But I mean it does seem to challenge the idea that – or it supports the idea that the underlying document has flaws. Now, I guess then the debate is just about how to fix it and change it.
I don't think – but
yes.
do originalists deny that the underlying document has flaws? I mean, they certainly
– No, they just say we're stuck with the flaws.
I mean, there's certainly like things about slavery. I
right.
mean, it's a constitution that endorsed slavery, for goodness sake.
Right. Well, then there
so
you
he's
go.
Saying,
then there's the answer.
So I think that's an intellectually okay position to hold, right?
Can we talk for a second about the devil? Because I felt like this was the most underwhelming part of the interview that got all this play, and I just didn't get it. Don't lots of Christians believe in the devil? I mean, I believe in God. I don't really believe in the devil because Jews don't make a big deal about the devil, but I feel like I could imagine believing in the devil. It doesn't seem that strange to believe in, you know, love and mercy and the good sides of God and then have the other side of the coin there too. And I felt like Jennifer Senior, if she really did betray shock about that, that was kind of being like the lady from the liberal elite that Scalia accused her of being.
Yeah, I agree. I think there, I don't know, there are numbers on this, but I don't think that everybody believes, I mean, even practicing Christians, I think the number for God is much higher than those who believe in the devil, but it shouldn't have been such a shock to her. I mean, that seemed really weird to me. Weirder than him believing in the devil. Of course he believes in the devil.
Right. I mean, if you start to believe in supernatural creatures that shape our destiny and guide what we're doing, why wouldn't you have a devil there as well? Once you've got a god, a devil seems like a natural
although John was just pointing out you could have a different view of it. You could believe in the God as this all-powerful force and not believe there is an equally powerful force for evil.
Right, but I guess from the position of someone who doesn't believe in either the God or the devil, they all seem equally ludicrous to me. So it doesn't – the fact that he believes in the devil is no more surprising to me than that he believes in God or that he believes his – you know, that Jesus was – you know, died and was resurrected. All those beliefs to me are ridiculous, and I recognize that many smart, wise, good-hearted people hold them and hold them in perfectly legitimate, great ways.
It was actually kind of good of her to leave it in because he was using it against her.
He was such a bully about it too.
Well, he's a bully about a lot of things in here. It's true. But I thought that he basically articulated the Slate motto when he said, "I feel less comfortable when everybody agrees with me." Right? Like he was totally being the country, like,
well, except
contrarianism.
That's sort of true, except.
Except it's not at all in anything he says. Like, he reads the Washington Times and doesn't read the Washington Post.
He consumes in his bubble.
Yeah.
I mean, so Dahlia Lithwick, our colleague, tweaked him for being somebody who only lives in his bubble. He lives in his conservative bubble where the only, you know, non-Supreme Court justices he meets are hunters, and the only media he consumes is conservative, like-minded conservative media, and he doesn't socialize except with conservatives. I don't feel that, like, Scalia is no different from anybody else in that regard, is he, Emily?
Yeah, no, that's not true.
Probably. You know what else
Wait,
struck
what?
Me as really
Wait, what
weird?
Do you mean probably? Hold on.
He's
what?
No different. Probably he's no different, she means.
You mean everybody is this cocooned?
You think
I
he's
think
that
lots
cocooned?
Lots of people are pretty damn
cocooned. Oh, he's totally cocooned.
I don't think he's that cocooned. First of all,
as cocooned as he sounds.
First of all, he has eight colleagues. Four of them have political beliefs that are antithetical to his, and four of them
with. But to Dahlia's point, I'm sorry. I thought you were saying that everybody is pretty much the way he is as Dahlia described him, which is a guy who doesn't seek out contrary opinions in his daily life.
I think most people don't seek out contrary opinions in their daily life. I think that is correct.
Yeah. Okay. All right. I thought you meant. Yeah. Okay. I think that's right. It's not good, but you're right. It's right. That's.
But David wasn't
right.
saying it was good. He was empirically observing it. Can I ask a different question? I thought it was really weird at the end of the interview when asked kind of what real principled stand have you taken that you're proud of? He talked about refusing to recuse himself to get off of a case because he'd gone duck hunting with Vice President Cheney. That's his great stand for principle. I mean, whatever. I don't really care about that, but I just thought there was something a little lame about that answer.
Speaking of lame things he said, he totally knees the memory of Gerald Ford in the most jerkish way. So he's talking about how it was terrible during the Ford administration. And he said, I mean, we had a president who'd never been elected anything except what? A district in Michigan? Everything was in chaos. Like, what a jerk. Like, I mean, you know, Gerald Ford was a leader in Congress. He was, like, considered at the time to be a decent and good person. Lots of people think he made him.
But I guess if you're, like, a real serious conservative, you consider him to be an enormous disappointment, and he irks you in that way that, you know, centrist liberals irk me.
But it's such a jerkish. Also, it's totally got conservatism sort of on its head. I mean, I don't know. It just is wrong in so many different ways.
He was no Ronald Reagan.
Emily, I want to ask one last question about this, which is, so Scalia is a celebrity, interestingly, and he likes mm-hmm. being a celebrity. Clearly, he revels in it. When did Supreme Court justices start to become celebrities? How did this happen?
John Marshall was incredibly sexy.
Was he sexy?
I was going to talk about the Warren Court. I wasn't going to go back that far. I mean, I wonder if I think Supreme Court justices, because they are not on television, have never had the same kind of face recognition that other famous political figures have. I wonder if you go back further to Oliver Wendell Holmes, if he seemed like a celebrity in his time, because that's pre-TV, so maybe it didn't matter as much. But I think it's a very recent phenomenon. And I think Scalia has a kind of celebrity that actually nobody else has. And part of it is that he is willing to give these very freewheeling interviews. I mean, it just seems like he doesn't care anymore. He feels like he can say anything other than, oh, hey, last week we had oral argument in this case, and this is how I'm going to vote.
You think he's the only one who has celebrity? I think Clarence Thomas has a huge celebrity. I think Kagan and Sotomayor and Ginsburg all have celebrity. I don't think, I mean, Breyer doesn't, but the others kind of do. I think John Roberts does.
Yeah, so maybe that's fair. I mean, Sonia Sotomayor's book was a big bestseller. Maybe you're right. Did you guys see Adam Liptak did this fun story in the Times about the laugh meter for the court? So it turns out that in the transcripts, the people who do them are really tough about saying laughter. And so some law professors went in and they listened to the tapes and they gave the justice credit for every single time there was a chortle. And it turned out that Justice Ginsburg is like a professional comic. She is cracking everybody up much, much more than she gets credit for. Not as much as Scalia, I think, but she sort of looks great, which I thought was very funny. Particularly in light of her comment about, you know, the umbrella for the voting rights, the skim milk for the gay rights. Like, she's just really got a number of one-liners going right now.
Who cracks them up least? Thomas doesn't speak.
And maybe Alito.
Yeah.
Huh. I would like to know that the last who finished last. Okay. That'll do it for the Political Gabfest portion of the show. You'll find a longer version of the show with more topics at slate.com/podcasts. I'm David Plotz in Washington. The Culture Gabfest starts now.
This is Gabfest Radio. I'm Stephen Metcalf. On this week's Slate Culture Gabfest, Gravity. It's the new Alfonso Cuarón space movie starring George Clooney and Sandra Bullock. And then Showtime has a new series about the pioneering researchers Masters and Johnsons. It's called Masters of Sex. And finally, The Future of Cool, with Slate's very cool music critic, Carl Wilson. Joining me today is Slate's deputy editor, Julia Turner. Hello, Julia.
Hi, Steve.
And of course, Slate's film critic, Dana Stevens. Hey, Dana.
Hello, Steve.
All right. Well, I should say I'm joining you guys again from Slate's Ghent Bureau, the plush Ghent Bureau. All right. Well, Gravity is the new film from the director Alfonso Cuarón, who also brought us the miraculous Y Tu Mama Tambien and the equally most excellent Children of Men. This movie stars Sandra Bullock as a researcher on her first mission in space and George Clooney as a veteran astronaut on his final mission. Hurtling space junk separates her from both Clooney and their space station, and what ensues is a thriller about her attempt to return to Earth. It sounds somewhat banal, but in my estimation, it's a meditation on what it is to be a terrestrial creature, and it did huge BO this weekend. It was $55 million plus. Dana, what did you think of this movie?
Well, I guess the short version is that I loved it. I mean, you can't go to this movie and not be kind of just visually dazzled and blown away by it, especially if you see it in 3D. Did you guys see it in 3D?
I did.
Yeah, this is one of those rare movies. You didn't, Steve?
I did, if you had waited to hear my answer.
No, I was just going to say, I think you guys will agree. This is one of the rare movies where I think the 3D makes a difference. And I didn't see it in IMAX, but I may try to go back and see it in that. But okay, I'm approaching your question obliquely. I think this is a beautiful film. I don't quite think it's a masterpiece for reasons that we can discuss. I think it has some script flaws and some places where it gets a little bit hokey, but I would definitely encourage people to go see it. And I'm enormously encouraged by the great box office it did over the weekend. It's just great to have an intelligent and artful and really beautifully put together, beautifully crafted movie just whomp everything else at the box office. I think it set an October record, and it also broke George Clooney's box office opening weekend record.
How can that be true?
Batman and Robin was the previous George Clooney best opening weekend, and now it's Gravity. I could be wrong, but I believe I read that fact.
Wow, that seems impossible.
Huh, interesting.
So the first thing, I guess, to say is that Alfonso Cuarón does something with his camera in Gravity that I've never seen anyone do on screen before. And it has to do with, well, for one thing, CGI. A lot of these images are created via computer. But it has to do with the way the viewer is oriented within the space, particularly in this 20-minute long opening shot that's sort of, you know, the showpiece of Gravity, the thing that pulls you into it. There's no cut whatsoever for the first, maybe not 20. I think it's a 17-minute shot, which is one of Cuarón's signature shots, to do these long takes with a lot of things moving in and out of frame. But of course, when you're doing that in space, in a place with no up and down, no foreground and background, and no weight, everything is sort of moving around the camera in this strange way. So there's an effect of disorientation where it's as if all of the things on screen, including space shuttles and spacewalking astronauts and flying bits of debris, are kind of whirling around you. And so that's something that takes a while to get used to, but it makes this movie really kind of intoxicating and dazzling to the eye.
Yeah, I saw it with my mother, who I realized shortly after we sat down and that film, that long sequence begins, is afraid of heights, and this may have been like the worst possible movie to bring her to of all movies of all time.
So did that make her hate it?
All you do is whirl around at things vertiginously far below you. And my sister, who afterwards said that was a lot more like a ride than it was a movie, and I thought that was a really apt summation of it. You feel like you're given an experience that you could never have in normal life, unless I suppose you are an astronaut, which very few people are, and it gives you an incredibly real sense or real feeling sense of what it would be like to, you know, just be using your space wrench to fix some things on the Hubble telescope and then have disaster strike and see what might happen. And I feel like the hyperrealism of the visuals and the devotion to conveying what the experience might be like is where the real power of the movie lies. Because I do think that the story, such as it is a weaker element of the movie, to the point of being at times laughably schlocky.
Before we get to my ever so precious opinion of this movie, why don't we listen to a clip from it?
Explore, do you copy?
You know, Julia, it's funny. What I pick out of what you said is that you saw it with someone who, you know, has a fear of falling. And it's funny, for me, it was sort of the virtue of the movie was sort of that it was about the opposite of the fear of falling, or about the opposite of provoking the fear of falling in a way, because it's so much about being in an environment in which up and down have been completely obviated. Your directional orientation is no longer terrestrial, and you are stranded in space, right? It's the one thing you can't do is fall, and that's what's, you know, utterly terrifying about the movie. That said, it does seem to me that Cuarón, who's an immensely intelligent and talented director, is way more interested in this idea and exploring this idea with the camera than he is in the specific genre elements of the movie, which strike me as somewhat attenuated, maybe even on purpose. But what it did mean is that I didn't really thrill along to the movie as a genre piece at all. And in fact, the thing that was meant to give it some emotional weight, which I won't give away, kind of hurtles at you like a piece of space junk. I mean, it just seems arbitrary and kind of stuck in order to make the thing seem...
Well, and it's totally unnecessary, right? She, you know, the tragedy of being adrift and off structure, loose in space, and trying to figure out how you're going to get home safely is sufficiently compelling, especially because everything the camera is doing is showing us how compelling and horrifying a moment she's trapped in. You don't really need the personal baggage schlocked on top of it.
I mean, the more daring way to make the movie is with way, way, way less dialogue, almost, you know, very little human voice. That's a tough way to make a Hollywood movie, but, you know, that was my feeling, is I thought I was going to see something that was, you know, in effect silent for 90 minutes and was surprised at how much jabber there was.
And a lot of breathing, as we heard in that clip. Intense, panicked, in-suit breathing.
I would still say for a blockbuster about outer space with Sandra Bullock and George Clooney, this is a remarkably minimalist and arty-feeling movie. It does surprise me to some extent that it's had the huge success that it has, and I wonder if that'll continue past the opening weekend and the novelty of, you know, wanting to see this thing that looks really different and really cool.
What did you guys think of Sandra Bullock in it? Are you guys Sandra Bullock fans? I don't think we've ever talked about a Sandra Bullock movie together.
What do I think of Sandra Bullock? Well, I think she's excellent in this part. It's interesting that he chose to cast two such movie stars. I mean, they're such movie stars that transcend their roles. And when you look at them, you always think, oh, there's Sandra Bullock and George Clooney. And that was obviously deliberate on Cuarón's part. I think she's really excellent in the role, but it keeps it in a Hollywood kind of zone that it wouldn't be in if we had even somebody who was known, you know, who was a known quantity, but who wasn't quite the Oscar-winning America's sweetheart that Sandra Bullock is. I do think that she and George Clooney have nice chemistry together, and there's a little bit of a screwball quality to the first hour of the movie or so when they're kind of jetting around together on a jetpack. I mean, in addition to the terror of hurtling through space untethered from a spaceship, there's also sort of a lot of, you know, goofy back and forth between the two of them, and that stuff worked for me. I think the hokiness sets in more in the second hour.
Yeah, I think that's true. I don't know. I find Sandra Bullock, of all the movie stars, to have been the right movie star, if that makes sense. I mean, she is somehow feels normal and relatable. I guess that's what the America's Sweetheart label connotes. But she feels earthy. She's always felt like a very earthy actress, which is part of why it's so interesting to see her suspended in space, I think.
That's true. And when she's physical and tomboyish and fits in an action role, right? I mean, from Speed on, she's been somebody who kind of, she's suited to those action roles as well as a kind of a romantic comedy. What about you, Steve? Are you not a Sandra Bullock fan?
I have never connected with someone who could be plausibly called America's sweetheart with the exception of Dana Stevens.
You've connected with me?
I guess that's where my argument falls apart.
And maybe it's because there's more distance between my seeing it and you guys, and I'm not getting this across, but I actually found this a pretty thrilling film. I mean, I was clutching my chair seats, and I was desperate for Sandra Bullock to get back to Earth, and I did cry along with her when her 3D tears floated gravityless toward us, even though that happened a few too many times and hammered it again too hard. I was moved and brought along, and even though there was some eye rolling along the way, I was able to forgive it, and I love this movie.
All right. Well, the movie is called Gravity. It's directed by Alfonso Cuarón. It stars George Clooney and Sandra Bullock. Go see it, and if you have strong feelings, come to our Facebook page and tell us what you think. That's facebook.com/culturefest. Coming up, the concept of cool has been with us for more than a half a century, but does it still mean what it used to? You're listening to Gabfest Radio from Slate and WNYC. This is Gabfest Radio. I'm Stephen Metcalf, along with Dana Stevens and Julia Turner, and this is the Culture Gabfest portion of the show. If you'd like to find links for things we mention on the program, we collect them on our show page, wnyc.org/gabfest. And please, if you would, leave a comment while you're there. Tell us what you think of us. That's wnyc.org/gabfest. All right, moving on. Masters of Sex is the new Showtime series based on a Thomas Mayer biography of Dr. William Masters and his partner, both eventually in life and in research, Virginia Johnson. They were the pioneering sex researchers at Washington University in St. Louis in the 1950s. The show stars Michael Sheen and Lizzie Kaplan. And why don't we, before we talk about it, why don't we listen to a clip?
I have your climax lasted approximately 9 seconds.
I was faking.
You didn't have an orgasm.
You're serious now?
Yes, I'm serious. You pretended to have an orgasm? Is that a common practice amongst prostitutes?
It's a common practice amongst anyone with a d-. Women fake orgasms, almost all of them, although I haven't checked my clipboard lately.
But why? Why would a woman lie about something like that?
God almighty, this is... Okay, I'm going to be honest with you. But only because I like you and you seem real dedicated about your project and your penguin suit and all with the charts and the timer. But seriously, if you really want to learn about sex, then you're going to have to get yourself a female partner.
Yeah, we should make clear that the conversation there was not between Masters and Johnson, between Michael Sheen and Lizzie Kaplan, but between Masters and a prostitute that he hires early on to help him with his sex study.
Yes, and she really does set up the theme of the pilot episode quite neatly there. Sounds like you really need a lady partner, fella.
See, I mean, actually, I'm glad we used that clip because that, to me, although I quite like this and it's lots of fun and I'm glad we're talking about it, but that sort of points out the weakness of the show to me. I think this show sort of like a poor man's Mad Men maybe, or a Mad Men for a slightly dumber demographic, and I feel like it stacks the deck in favor of women in a way that's like, even as a woman, I find a little bit condescending. Essentially, the Lizzie Kaplan character, Virginia Johnson, can sort of do no wrong, and we can talk about some moments where I find that a little bit irritating, but I think it just kind of takes away from the intellectual rigor of the show.
You're right. That's such a good point. It's interesting because Mad Men is a totally fascinating show for the modern woman to watch because it showcases this world where a woman's life was full of unimaginable constraints, right? And those constraints get almost played up, perhaps too much for effect on Mad Men, but they exist and they represent a thought experiment. I mean, it's almost like watching Gravity when you watch Mad Men. It's watching time in a world where the forces of the world as you know them no longer apply.
And right. There's inexorable laws that must govern right. every relationship.
Right. And Masters of Sex, perhaps admirably, is a little bit less rigid about that. I mean, I think in a lot of ways the culture probably was more fluid than it's portrayed as on Mad Men. But the Lizzie Kaplan character, and I love Lizzie Kaplan. She's one of my favorite actresses. She's just so delightful on screen. You just want to watch her do whatever it is that she's going to do next. She does sort of seem like the sassy best friend, like transported back from the modern time to be like, wow, guys, y'all are so straight-laced. Let me show you how it's done. I'm going to have a lot of sex. I'm going to be super comfortable with my body. And let's just see if we can get this scientific study on the road, Mr. Uptight Masters. Like, she's mm-hmm. it's fun to watch, but the plausibility factor, it lacks.
I mean, speaking of the plausibility factor, what is this about the socialist myth of the female orgasm? I mean...
Do you have questions for us, Steve?
I mean, the next thing you know, cats and dogs are living together, Julia Turner. I do not approve of this at all. No, I liked the show enormously. I thought it was, you know, very stylishly presented. It was smartly written. It does have that Mad Men problem, though, which is that it's sort of an advertorial for the present tense. And then kind of, and relatedly, a kind of advertorial for itself, right? Like, I mean, the moment that made me wince was when, I can't remember if it's the Lizzie Kaplan character, when she says, this will be the biggest breakthrough for women since the right to vote. You know, so sort of billboards are somewhat self-congratulatory relationship to the past. It pretends to be very knowing and very smart. At the same time, it's naive about and self-congratulatory about the nature of progress, I think, and it says that to the audience over and over and over again. But I thought it was, I mean, I love Michael Sheen. Anything Michael Sheen is in this, to me, is just a delight.
Yeah, I think the show works because of the actors more so than because of the writing, at least in its early episodes. And then I'm just curious to see where it goes and how it develops, because it seems to me that it could end up having some smart and interesting things to say about the nature of sexuality, given the rich subject matter and the rich history that it's working with. And the show seems smart enough that it might work out its pilot kinks and get to a place where it has interesting things to say, but it's not quite there yet.
Also, it's a Showtime show. Showtime is famous for its prurient content, and this show is not above just putting in a nice softcore sex scene with some good-looking random people, which, of course, a show about people having sex in a lab for other people to watch has every narrative excuse to do. So there were a couple moments that I sort of felt like, oh, really? You know, do we have to have the L-word style, you know, shot of the woman's face in ecstasy or whatever? I mean, I guess that's what people are tuning into this show for. But it seemed like moments when the show was sort of sneaking in, you know, using its scientific mandate to just sneak in some smut.
Yeah. I mean, I feel like in classifying cable dramas these days, there's so much good stuff on television to watch. But I also feel like I've started classifying them between truly amazing works of art that have interesting things to say about life and the world and just super slick and compelling stories that are told with an exquisite attention to detail, acting quality and writing quality that's a cut above what you would find on network. So in the genius masterpiece category, I would put The Wire, Mad Men, Breaking Bad. In the schlocky entertainment category, I would put House of Cards, Homeland. And this one feels to me like it's landing on the schlock side for the moment, but I'm willing to kind of give it a buy and see if it takes it anywhere more sophisticated as it goes on.
But as schlock goes, it's pretty peppy, fun to watch schlock.
I think part of what's jarring about it is all of the points that the show is striving to make about sex feel, at least for now, not particularly fascinating since we live in such a hypersexualized culture, right? The culture that they're describing is the polar opposite of the culture we currently inhabit, where, you know, the lyrics of popular songs are just incredibly explicit about precise sexual acts and desires. You know, more and more we're seeing music videos where people are just naked everywhere. I mean, there's sex is all over. It's all in front of us. Nothing is repressed. Everything is known. And so I'm curious to see how the show develops this tension, right? It's sort of quaint to see them espousing sexual knowledge as something that could liberate us and make us happy when we've now seemed to have gone so far beyond that.
Well, the show is called Masters of Sex. It's on Showtime. It stars Michael Sheen and Lizzie Kaplan. If you check it out and have an opinion, come share it with us on our Facebook page. All right, well, moving on. Cynicism is difficult to avoid when the subject of cool arises now. Self-conscious indie rockers are easy targets, vulnerable to charges of recycling half-century-old postures that were arguably purloined from African-American culture in the first place. So writes Carl Wilson, Slate's new music critic. Carl joins us to talk about Slate's new month-long series on what cool is now. Welcome to the show, Carl.
Hi, everybody.
Carl, I'm going to do the nearly unforgivable. I'm going to ask you the very rhetorical question that you peg at the top of your piece. What is cool in 2013? But more importantly, why are we still using this term when it does seem a little bit, it seems a little bit antique now?
Well, I think that cool kind of has an unusual status among slang terms in that it actually, you know, it has managed not to ever become dated since it became kind of common currency somewhere between the 40s and the 60s. And I think that that's because the thing that it denotes, unlike most of those kinds of slang terms, you know, groovy or rad or tubular,
they're
all kind of hot terms, you know. So they immediately start to seem kind of earnest and gormless after a little while, whereas cool, because the whole notion of it has this kind of restrained or withdrawn sense about it, never quite falls into that category. So that's sort of why we might still be using the term. For what cool is now, like, I think the thing is that cool has become our actual, the actual measure by which our culture regards itself to such an extreme that, you know, it was sort of a concept that was at once countercultural and then became sort of taken over as a term of marketing and then just became pervasive. And in 2013, you have this situation where culture is ephemeral, where culture rises, bubbles up, there's what is the subject of mind that week, and things are not lasting in this way. And so cool is kind of everywhere and nowhere in that sense. It's kind of lost its center. And that may mean that it's no longer really a term with that much content when what's cool in the morning on, you know, the social media or on the sort of aggregate sites is uncool by afternoon or by evening. And so It has that ephemerality, but it also has this kind of pervasive force where, in some ways, cool is an economic term now, and being cool, having your personal brand, having that brand be cool, is kind of obligatory to survive in this kind of economy of knowledge and of reputation.
One thing I thought was really interesting about your analysis, Carl, was this notion that part of being cool is being aware of everything that is or could be perceived to be cool, right? That and I guess in that way the term cool is somewhat analogous with hip, which means literally in some uses to be aware of, right? But that I was struck because I saw a photograph on Facebook a couple of days ago of a little kid planking, right? Remember planking, the meme that went around, you know, 2 or 3 years ago where people lay like rods on top of weird objects? And planking itself was not ever actually cool, but being aware that planking was a thing that was done is the thing that was cool, right? And seeing, you know, this 7-year-old plank helps you understand that, right? Like, to a kid, the meme itself is the thing that's fun to do. But to a presumably cool adult, just being aware of all the memes that circulate is part of what coolness is today, which seemed slightly depressing, right? It seemed like just being aware of the stream of news as opposed to actually participating in and enjoying and having feelings and ideas about any particular item of news in your stream or your cultural feed of things to obsess about and be aware of, right?
Yeah, and to be able to sort of ironically refer to those things without seeming to participate in them too naively, all of that kind of thing.
Give us a little bit of the grounding in the history. Why should we care about what cool means now? You argue in your essay that cool actually had an important and in some respects political role to play in our evolution as a culture in the middle of the last century, which is perhaps what gives some weight to the way the meanings of the term have changed in this one.
You know, arguably, cool is actually one of those terms, sort of like bad meaning good, that got flipped by African-American culture from its original meaning. And although there are examples of it being used in the somewhat modern sense earlier, often cool in the 19th century, sort of the Victorian sensibility, was actually criticism. You'd say that's cool, as in meaning that's kind of brutal of you, that's unwarm. But some art historians and cultural historians have traced back the idea of cool to West African ideas they had the term etutu, which meant a composure in the face of danger, but also an ability to sort of negotiate fluidly with different sides and have a kind of playful ability to not overly commit to a position so that you could reach some more ideal situation. And it was kind of an idea of being civilized, which got carried over here in slavery and kind of became a defense mechanism and a way of surviving through slavery, and then migrated out of that into culture. Actually, a piece other than mine in Slate series found an example in the sort of late 19th century of a dictionary of African-American slang at the time, which just, without commenting on what it meant, noted black people saying, that's cool. But it really emerged out of that through the jazz world into sort of mainstream use.
It is true that you often see cool from the outside, right? You're more, there is a status thing, right? I mean, even if you think about the cool kids in school or something like that, you're often observing and appreciating the unflappable cool of someone else while feeling your own hot fluster, rather than just walking through the world feeling totally cool.
Right. The whole idea of cool is sort of the assumption, the false assumption, that there's someone who's beyond vulnerability, right? And that you can somehow ape the behavior of that person.
All right. Well, the series is called Cool Story. It's a month-long series of essays about the nature of cool in 2013 on Slate.com. Its introduction was written by Carl Wilson, Slate's wonderful and very cool new music critic. Carl, thank you so much for coming on the show.
It's been cool.
All right. Now is the moment in our podcast where we endorse. Dana Stevens, what do you have?
All right, I'm going to endorse an older Alfonso Cuarón movie. When you think of Alfonso Cuarón's career, you think of the movies you mentioned, Steve, Y Tu Mamá También, and the Harry Potter movie he directed, The Prisoner of Azkaban, which is pretty much universally agreed to be the best Harry Potter movie, and, of course, Children of Men. But a movie that really got him his start in Hollywood and gave him the cred to start making these bigger Hollywood spectacles was A Little Princess, the 1995 adaptation of the same Frances Hodgson Burnett novel that I just mentioned recently in our call-in show about children's books. Orphan books that I loved as a child. So A Little Princess is a book that I have completely visualized in my mind since reading it as a child. And I will not say that Cuarón achieved that vision. He did something completely different. For one thing, he moves the location from London to New York. But he keeps it a period piece. He casts really wonderful, not very known people. And he just is such an imaginative filmmaker that he's able to capture this book, which is all about the imagination of this little girl in an orphanage living a horrible life. So it's very watchable with your children, but it's also just a terrific movie, A Little Princess from 1995.
Oh, absolutely. My kids will adore it, I'm sure. Julia, what do you got?
I would like to endorse something very simple, very consumable. You could go listen to it right after you finish listening to this show. It is the most recent episode of the Planet Money podcast. I'm sure that at some point I have endorsed Planet Money before. It is so consistently good that I sometimes forget to appreciate how good it is. But they've been doing this at this point, it seems like years-long series about trying to produce a Planet Money T-shirt. They've stopped to do little mini episodes about all of the different aspects of shirt making, shirt manufacture, and shirt sale. And one thing that they became curious about was, why does it take so long to wire transfer money? Why is it so hard to transfer money from one bank account to another in America? They tried to transfer some money that they earned on Kickstarter to a bank account, just a private bank account somewhere, and it took them 5 to 7 days. And so they go and investigate why this happens and uncover this completely arcane and archaic, bizarre system that has its roots in the 1970s and a system where banks used to actually all bring trucks to meet in neutral ground parking lots and swap bags of checks for each other. It's a completely retrograde system, and most other countries have one that's much better. And they just get to the bottom of this completely invisible underpinning of our American economy with their trademark style, wit, thoroughness, and great reporting. And it's a terrific lesson. So I endorse that.
Fantastic. All right. Well, my endorsement, I have to admit, I'm embarrassed to confess that I hadn't encountered her music until I was in a great record shop in Hudson, New York. And over the speakers came Amalia Rodriguez, the legendary fado singer.
Oh, yeah, she's the best.
I mean, it was just, it's like reaching the age of, 40 and never having heard Billie Holiday. I mean, it's and when you hear it, you realize, oh, this is both a joyful, threshold I've just walked over, but it's also, a badge of shame. How could I not? I mean, this is so totally primal going forward to my understanding of music. And it just, she's just incredible. I mean, it really is up there with discovering Billie Holiday. All right. Thank you, Dana.
Thanks, Steve.
Thanks, Julia.
Thank you.
You'll find links to some of the things we talked about on today's program at wnyc.org/gabfest, where you can also leave a comment. And you'll find the longer podcast versions of our shows on iTunes, SoundCloud, wherever you get your podcasts. Just search for Slate Gabfest. Gabfest Radio is a production of Slate.com, which is solely responsible for its content. The producers are Sally Herships, Chris Wade, and Mike Vuolo. Our interns are Rebecca Cohen and Anna Schechtman. The executive producer is Andy Bowers. For everyone on the Gabfest crew, I'm Stephen Metcalf. We'll talk to you next week.